This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. The snow seems to have buried everything, but it didn't bury all the news we had this week, beginning with the budget. Governor Deval Patrick says sometimes in order to save, you've got to cut. So he proposed a budget leaner than any we've seen in two decades.
This budget proposes to reduce spending by $570 million. The largest year-over-year spending reduction in 20 years.
Plus, former city councilor Chuck Turner gets a three-year prison sentence for taking a $1,000 bribe.
And the judge said he was very comfortable giving more time to me because I'd lied on the stand. I didn't lie.
And it's not yet February, and so far we've had more than 60 inches of snow in Boston. These are just some of the stories we'll be discussing in our News of the Week in Review. With us to do just that is Peter Canellos, editorial page editor of the Boston Globe. Hi again, Peter.
Hi, Meghna.
And also with us here in the studio is Ken Cooper. He's a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist here in Boston. He also edits the Trotter Review, a journal of articles addressing current black studies, race, and race relations in the United States and abroad. Ken Cooper, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Thank you.
Listeners, I got to ask you, are you happy that the governor is slashing the state's budget? Do you think justice was served in the Chuck Turner case? And we also want to acknowledge possibly the biggest story of the week that's unfolding right now. That happens to actually be in Egypt, the anti-government protest erupting all over Egypt and Cairo. So listeners, we want to hear from you on that story and any story of the week. If you happen to be of Egyptian descent, if you have connections to Egypt, we'd love to hear how you're feeling about this news. And if you've heard from anything from your friends or relatives in Egypt, give us a call at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. So let's start right off in our News of the Week review with the governor's budget. As we mentioned, it's a $570 million cut that Governor Patrick is proposing, including the closing of two of the state's prisons, changing how the state pays for health care, cutting local aid by $65 million. Governor Patrick says that he claims that these short-term cuts are going to help strengthen Massachusetts in the long run. Ken Cooper, your thoughts?
Well, it's a tough situation, and in situations like these, chief executives of the country or the state, what they try to do is spread the pain, which I think he's done. Surely the details will change as the legislature works its will. And something else that he's doing with closing the prisons and not incarcerating nonviolent drug offenders is something many states are doing. They're changing their laws to divert those people from prison because they can't afford to incarcerate them or as many of them as they have in the past. So we'll see what the legislature says. I mean, I think his approach is basically what it should be to spread the pain, and he doesn't have many options other than that.
Peter Canellos, do you see that this as a sort of an equitable spreading of the pain across the entire state budget?
I think it's fairly equitable. I also think that the governor deserves some credit for trying to effect savings through reform in a number of these areas. We haven't seen a lot of details on the Medicaid side of things, but we have in corrections, we have in the proposal to hire more public defenders instead of hiring lawyers on a contract basis to defend people. If these numbers are real and if these reforms work, he'll have sort of helped the Commonwealth over a very difficult fiscal period while also making some necessary kind of belt-tightening moves that might actually benefit us in the long run.
Well, I wonder if I could ask you a little bit more about these consolidation efforts. We've seen a couple of proposals come out of the governor's office recently. He wants to combine the parole and probation departments. And we also just recently heard him propose that the current system of using 3,000 private lawyers as public defenders should actually be made into 1,000 full-time state employees who are lawyers in a public defender's office, also in the executive branch, moving that out of the judiciary. So there seems to be a lot of consolidation that the governor's trying to pull into his own branch of office. Ken Cooper, do you see that as Governor Patrick saying, you know, I can do it better?
Well, given our recent experience with both the parole board and the probation department, I mean, it's a reasonable proposition for him to assert. I think there are a couple of issues here. One is, I think when it comes to courts, they really what they do is not really administer things. I mean, it's what judges normally don't do. So it's, in some ways, it's not surprising that things like the probation department that judges administer, when they're not used to doing that, perhaps things go awry. On the other hand, with both of these proposals, I have some qualms about the impact on the criminal justice system. I think it is important that the probation officers work for the court and serve the court and advise the court. And if they're working for the state executive branch, as in some cases with state prosecutions, the prosecutors would be, to me that's a little uncomfortable and perhaps a conflict of interest. And with the public defenders, I'm a little concerned because in many states across the country, in fact, I was writing about one recently, Missouri, public defenders of the kind he wants to create are overwhelmed, overworked, so much so in Missouri, law professors are talking about perhaps the right to counsel is being violated because the defenses are inadequate by these overworked defenders.
Peter Kanellis, let me ask you, I mean, the current Chief Justice of the Supreme Judicial Court, Roderick Ireland, a justice who Governor Patrick himself nominated to be elevated to the chief's position, he's come out and said he doesn't actually agree with the merger of the parole and probation department. So what do you think is the governor actually truly up to here?
I don't know that the governor's up to anything nefarious, if that's
not necessarily
a suggestion.
But I do think
this bears a little bit more scrutiny. I mean, we have been tentatively supportive of the idea of moving the probation department under the governor because we feel like that's the best way to insulate it from political corruption, so that if there's one person who's responsible and that person is a political person in the case of the governor, you can blame him if legislators start getting their favorites in there. I think that as Ken was suggesting, judges aren't as experienced in administering and overseeing things, and so the potential for some of the kind of cronyism that we've seen in the past to take root is a little bit greater if the judiciary is overseeing it. Nonetheless, Roderick Ireland, who spent part of his career as a juvenile court justice, makes very strong cases about how closely he believes probation officers and judges should be working together, and I think it bears a little bit more scrutiny to sort of see what the actual structure will look like and if there's a way to, again, as Ken was suggesting, to have the judges work closely with the probation officers, even if the probation officers report ultimately to the governor. Mm.
We are talking about the news of the week in review, everything from Governor Patrick's proposed budget to the news of political unrest and major anti-government protests in Egypt to the snow we've been having. If you've had it up to here, oh, I know you can't see me since this is the radio, but I'm pointing over my head up to here with the snow, give us a call at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Matt is calling from Alston. Welcome to Radio Boston, Matt.
Hi, thanks for having me.
What's your thought today?
I just had a question. I had been reading that in the governor's budget that there was going to be cuts to homeless shelters. But that was because they were trying to put more emphasis on more permanent housing and getting them out of shelters. And I was just wondering if you could maybe talk a little bit about that. I had read that, and I wasn't sure exactly what was going on there.
Thanks so much for your call, Matt. I believe the governor proposed some $23 million cut to homeless shelters, but saying that it's not going to force people to live on the street, as Matt said, because there's permanent housing for people who are maybe temporarily homeless. Ken Cooper, is that true? Do you know if we have an adequate amount of permanent housing to buffer the effects of the cut?
Well, that's the question, and also the question whether the state or whatever service agency is working on behalf of homeless people have access to that housing, and if the people who live in those neighborhoods will open up their arms to these folks. The approach that the governor outlines has been tried successfully in some places. I know in my hometown of Denver, where I grew up, it's been tried and it's worked pretty well. But it does depend on the supply and availability of housing and also the ability of whatever institutional intermediary to secure that housing and provide the transitional services that someone's used to sleeping on the street needs to actually live in their own home and take care of it and be a responsible tenant.
Let's get another call in here. George is calling from Harrison, Maine. Welcome to Radio Boston, George.
Hi. So my issue is that Turner's has no legitimate complaint. The complaint would be the rest of the people who have been convicted of fraudulently representing the constituents while making all kinds of deals, aren't in jail. And by my understanding, the last three or four speakers of the House have been convicted of one thing or another, and they should all be in jail. Not take seriously.
George, thank you so much for your call. So Peter Kennels, that call about City Councilor Chuck Turner getting 3 years in prison for taking that $1,000 bribe. Does the punishment fit the crime?
I think in Turner's case it does, especially because it is total lack of repentance or any kind of acknowledgement of even bad judgment in this exchange. You know, his decision to defend himself by absolutely loudly, you know, turning the guns on the prosecutors and even mentioning John Ashcroft and Alberto Gonzalez and things like that, you know, has raised a question about whether he, you know, in any way is prepared to acknowledge his crime. So I think it is appropriate. The separate issue of whether these speakers should also be in prison is such an apples and oranges question because they were all convicted of different things, and it's very, very hard to parse these different crimes. And I think given, you know, Chuck Turner's determination to sort of assert racial double standards and to sort of hide some of his bad behavior behind that, I would not be sympathetic to Chuck Turner. Nonetheless, as the caller said, you know, maybe we can get tougher on some of these other people whose offenses are financial and more complicated and more shielded. That's a point well taken. I think we should be, the judicial system should be as vigilant as possible about political corruption and take the same vigilance that was applied to Turner and apply it to all the cases.
Ken Cooper, does it really feel like apples and oranges to you? Because if I remember correctly, in Diane Wilkerson's sentencing, there was a hint from the judge, perhaps, that it, you know, he was thinking of all of those three House speakers who had been indicted but not necessarily served any jail time. So is it apples and oranges?
Well, I mean, I disagree with Peter on this one. I think the sentence is harsh. In any relative terms, I think we'll go forward. We'll take a look at if $1,000 bribe taking leads to 3 years, you start doing multiples and see if somebody who takes 10,000 does 30, 100,000, you do 300. I don't think so. That said, there are plenty of questions about the counselor's veracity on the stand and elsewhere. And in my view, his sentence is pretty much a self-inflicted wound, even his conviction perhaps, because he took the stand against his lawyer's advice. He's an elected official, a politician who seemed to have forgotten the basic law of politics is that 90% of political wounds are self-inflicted, and he inflicted one on himself here.
Let's get another call in here. Rashad is calling from Arlington. Welcome to Radio Boston, Rashad.
How you doing?
I'm doing very well. What's your thought today?
I'm actually an American with Egyptian descent, and just wanted to weigh in a little bit on what's going on today. From speaking to my family and friends back home and here, I think everybody is very, very, very excited and happy that, you know, no one thought this day was going to come when finally people start, you know, waking up and asking for freedom and asking for their rights and very basic rights, you know, and asking to have a voice, especially youth, myself in my 20s, you know, we were born and we didn't know anybody, you know, running Egypt other than Mubarak,
mm-hmm.
and with no chance for anybody else to run and no dreams of any type of change. And this this was really, really a happy event for us. Even if it goes, even if it doesn't go all the way, it's still really, you know, happy. And I'm so happy and excited to see the people actually starting to speak out.
Rashad, let me just ask you briefly. We've been hearing that a lot. There's been a lot of activity amongst young people in Egypt on things like Facebook, actually. Have you been hearing from friends and family in Egypt through these social networking sites?
It was until the internet was cut.
Yeah.
Recently, the internet and phones are cut, so the only way we could call family right now was through landlines. But before that, yes, there was a lot of activities. Actually, we didn't know the news, the up-to-date news, unless we have Facebook more than anything else. And actually, if you listen to Al Jazeera or anything else, they were taking the videos off of Facebook and putting them on on TV.
Rashad, thank you so much for your call. That word there from an Arlington Egyptian-American about what's currently happening in Cairo. And, you know, I mentioned Facebook, and that's partially because, at least on, amongst my friends, it's been a hot bit of activity regarding the snow that we've been having. So if I could actually turn the tables to that issue, which is one that's majorly on people's minds. I just want to read this posting that I saw this morning from one of my friends who lives in a Boston suburb. She said, I had an epic meltdown today after my daughter had an epic meltdown over snow boots. Her meltdown ended with her boots stuck in a snowdrift with her on top with a bare foot. Then my meltdown began. The only thing not melting is the snow. And now I have canceled all play dates, movies, presents, and fun for the next 2 weeks. Parenting must be so much easier in the South. Sigh, sigh. So Peter Canellas, while it is kind of dreary and grouchy making all this snow, it's actually costing cities and towns quite a bit. I mean, we've heard on Radio Boston that a lot of places have already run out of money in their snow budgets.
I'm sure that's true. The state law and state government encourages people to, you know, keep on plowing, keep on cleaning, and they'll extend credit to cities and towns for that. So I hope that many places aren't looking to cut any corners, because as your that email that you read suggests, you know, people really are getting fed up, and it's a sort of difficult thing to see. A lot of people are missing appointments. A lot of people are having problems with their cars. It's not a good week because of all the snow.
Let's just get a quick call in here from someone who knows this probably better than anybody. Mary is calling from Woburn. Welcome to Radio Boston, Mary.
Hi, I drive a plow, and this last storm was particularly difficult. I went out and plowed at 1 a.m., and at that time it wasn't coming down very heavily, so I set my alarm clock for 5:30, and I went out at 6, and by that time we had another 10 inches, which is more than what my plow can accommodate. My driveway is steep, and so I was able to get out, you know, going down the driveway, but I wasn't able to easily get up again. Usually I can help out my neighbors, and if I'm doing an errand, and I see somebody who's shoveling by hand with a shovel, I stop and ask them. But this time, it was a tremendous challenge just to get myself out.
Mary, thank you so much for your call. You know there's a lot of snow when it's even tough for the plow drivers. But on that note, we're almost out of time for our News and Week in Review. But before we go, as we do every week, what are the hubbubs that you guys have got? Those news stories that didn't quite make it to this table, but still worth a mention. Ken Cooper.
Well, my story is about, my hubbub is Northeastern University, which in not that long, maybe a generation, has gone from basically an open enrollment local commuter college to the most popular private university in the country based on the number of applications it received for next year's academic year.
Some 10,000 more than Harvard received, if I read that correctly. Wow, yeah. An incredible change.
They surpassed NYU and USC.
Wow, amazing. Lots of action on Huntington Avenue there. Peter Canellis, your hubbub.
Vertex Pharmaceuticals is moving from Cambridge to Boston, and that's being hailed as a big victory for the waterfront, where the new Seaport District, where they want to create high-tech firms. But how much of a victory is it when it's two Massachusetts cities that are right next to each other competing for a company? I'd much rather see city and town governments, especially when they're near to each other, getting together to try to attract companies from other places, including overseas, to come here rather than having to squander our resources trying to give a better deal just to move one town over.
Yeah, build an industry rather than try and make companies compete against each other. Well, yeah. My hubbub, I think I'm a little snow obsessed, but my hubbub has to do with the snow, and it actually has to do with a project that WBUR just launched today regarding all those snow-covered sidewalks we've been trying to get over and across this week. The city is looking for help identifying which sidewalks and roadways are still in need of clearing, and we are trying to do our bit online at WBUR.org. So we've set up a way for you to report unshoveled sidewalks, wheelchair ramps, and blocked fire hydrants. Your report will be added to an interactive map that we're compiling right now, so you can add to it by going to WBUR.org, or you can text the word WALK to 69866 on your cell phone. Again, the word to text is WALK 69866 is the number. That's my hubbub for the day. Peter Canellos, editorial page editor at the Boston Globe, have a fantastic weekend.
Same to you.
And Ken Cooper, Pulitzer Prize winning journalist and editor of the Trotter Review, thank you so much and have a great weekend to you as well.
Thank you, Meghna.
Up next, a closer look at internet infidelity. If you know what I'm talking about, give us a call at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.